Hey guys, this is Spencer. We have a really cool treat this week. We've got an extra bonus podcast that we didn't even have to do any work for.
Yay.
This is Luke Dicken. He spoke to the Salt Lake International Game Developers Association meeting. He talked to us about AI, and I'm going to just let you straightway listen to this awesome lecture. It takes about an hour. It gets a little nerdy, but there's some very valuable things that he discusses on what the game industry should be moving towards. Thanks for listening, and keep posted. We got a second half of our postmortem coming soon. Bye.
Excited to have Luke speaking, and we'll let him get started right away since he's stayed up so late for us. Thank you.
Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Excellent, that's a good start. Okay, so today I've got something, this is all new, well, mostly new, some of it's new. And I'm going to be talking about diversity in NPC AI. Don't get worried, it's okay. It's not a diversity talk. It's just called that. if you want to heckle at me as we're going along, you can use @LukeD on Twitter, and you can, if you wait 3 seconds, right, I've closed Twitter, so you won't bother me. Okay. So yeah, it's 2 a.m. here, so I will try not to be too long with this stuff. I don't know a whole lot about Salt Lake City. All we really hear is that you guys had the Olympics that one time, and you have a lot of Mormons, and that means that all we really know is that you don't drink and you don't swear, so congratulations on booking me. With that said, I'll just crack on. So the first slide is a little bit about who I am. So I started with AI pretty young. I got into a game called Creatures. And Creatures... Well, my presenter display has really just died, but we'll carry on anyway, and I'll see if I can remember this stuff. So Creatures was a game back in the 90s. I was about 14 when this game came out, and it was more of a sort of artificial life simulator than anything else. It was these little creatures, and you bred them from being sort of very young, and you trained them, you taught them things about the world they were in, and then you could reproduce them. And it was being driven by genetic algorithms and neural networks and all sorts of clever stuff like that. For the time, it was actually really quite advanced. And it got me hooked at an early age, and I sort of, that was what I wanted to do, was get into AI in particular, but with a very sort of an AI for games kind of bent. And I was quite lucky, because on my doorstep, a couple of hours away from me, was the University of Edinburgh. And pretty much when it comes to AI, if it wasn't invented at MIT, it was invented at Edinburgh. So that was really quite useful. So I went there for my first 2 degrees. So I got my Bachelor's of Science and my Master of Science there. And then I moved over to Strathclyde, which is close to my hometown. It's back in Glasgow. And I started out doing a PhD, but then I transferred to do a Master of Research, and then I've gone back to the PhD. But what I was finding, and what I still find, is that academics are, I'll be nice and say that they're a little bit out of touch. They kind of don't really engage so well with what's actually happening in industry, and particularly from an AI point of view, what's happening in industry is actually really quite sort of useful, and there's a lot happening. So I formed a little studio, and for a time there were a few of us working there, and it's now back down to me. People like money. I don't understand it, but if you can't pay people, then they tend to sort of go, oh, well, that's quite nice. but I need to get paid. And then they sign on with an employee, an employer, and the employer says, oh, don't moonlight on the side, so then you lose all your people who you were working with, which is not brilliant. IGDA, hang on, I'm just going to drop out of my slides because I really need my talking points back. Just shows that I actually can't do this blind. Okay. Right, so we did that one. Okay, right, I can see what I'm doing again. Woohoo! So IGDA scholarships. I'll talk a little bit about these again at the end. But I was fortunate enough to be one of the first three-time IGDA scholars in the world, which kind of meant I've accrued this great life debt to the organization, which is why I do chapter meetings like this. I'm also chair of the Special Interest Group on AI, and I'm a director for the Scottish chapter of the IGDA. If you ever glance at the IGDA's newsletter that comes out every month, you'll see a student beat column. I write that every month. I also write for AltDev Blog a Day, Gamma Sutra. Over summer, a bunch of us got together and we put together a new textbook that's called The Collected Wisdom of Game AI Professionals. A couple of pages of that have been written by me. But a couple of chapters have actually been edited by me, and that's got a lot of interesting articles in it. That's going to be out sometime in summer. If you're interested in what I'm talking about today, it's definitely a good thing to look up. As you can see from the cover, it's got a Supreme Commander 2 article, it's got Killzone, it's got Crisis, it's got some more sort of intro stuff in it as well. So this is the kind of thing that I'm doing in my spare time. I also run the AltDev stuff, which is a series of online events, a little bit like this, in fact, where we get a bunch of developers together and we schedule them for one weekend, and they all get together. Hundreds of people tune in and listen, and then we put the videos up on YouTube, all free, giving back to the community. So, like I said a couple of bits ago, I'm a PhD student now. And theoretically, I should be finishing sometime eventually. Hopefully this year, maybe. And actually, because of everything else that I've been doing, last month, Develop Magazine here in the UK put out one of these 30 developers under 30 years old thing, and they put me on that list, which was really quite honouring, humbling, and awesome. So I was quite happy about that. So get on now with some proper content. So first slide, I'm going to talk a little bit of real talk to you. Because what we know is that for 2011, our industry was globally worth $74 billion. I actually saw a stat for Kickstarter today. Kickstarter in 2012, in the games category alone, raised $83 million. So, I mean, that's leaving aside AAA, that's leaving aside all retail, all digital. It is including stuff like card games and board games, but, it's our industry is huge, and our industry is growing at a really massive rate. And it's a fantastic time to be a game developer. So I know a few of you have got Ouya boxes. We can develop for all sorts of stuff. The barrier to actually shipping our stuff is so much lower than it had been maybe even 5 years ago. And the tools that we can use, Unity is free to use, and Unity free can actually get you a hell of a lot of the way to where you need to be in order to be shipping something. And we've got a bigger audience than ever. We've got more people playing these games, and we've not only got more people, we've got more devices. Everybody is walking around these days with something in their pockets that can play a game. And that is completely different from where we've been in the past. And, it's not just consoles. It's now mobile devices. It's now handheld gaming machines. Consoles have got a broader adoption even in the last few years. PCs are getting broader adoption. Stuff like tablets is driving everything. And we've got more people than ever making games. We've got students coming through who are, you've got UAT, you've got the Utah University has a game dev degree. In Scotland, we've got three or four universities awarding game dev degrees, and that is something that we haven't had. So it follows then that the diversity that we should be seeing in games is absolutely amazing, right? We should be seeing so many different kinds of games coming through, which, it's true, we are doing. I mean, we've got games like The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead is a fantastic zombie game. We've got Left 4 Dead, which is a fantastic zombie game. We've got Call of Duty, which is a fantastic zombie game. We've got Resident Evil 6. And we've got Killing Floor, and that's amazing. We've got this great diversity. And 2013 is going to be an amazing year as well, because we've got Dead Space 3 coming out. And we've got Fortnite coming out. And we've got Dead Island Riptide, and these were the three that I could grab for some screenshots to highlight the point. But what I really want to drive home, and what I'm getting at, and actually what I titled this talk in the first place before I decided to make it a little bit more cryptic: what is with all the zombies? So I'm going to tell you what's with all the zombies, because really it is lazy, lazy, lazy game developers. From an NPC point of view, zombies, we do not expect to be particularly intelligent. What do you need to be a zombie? You need to be somebody who shuffles about a bit, you need to groan a little bit, and it would be quite good if you could react to noise, maybe, or light, or something like that. And that's basically all you need to be a zombie. Being a zombie is like the easiest job in the world ever. So zombies are easy. Zombies are the lowest hanging fruit of character design. They are this ridiculous trope that is nothing. I mean, it is just guys going, oh, yeah, we need enemies. Zombies. Right, let's go down the pub. Because, all you have to do really is determine which type of zombie you're going to have. Because, of course, now that zombies have become so popular, you have different types emerging. We have the canonical slow shuffling zombie, or the sort of Left 4 Dead kind of fast runny zombie. And that's your character design decision, and you're done. And from an AI point of view, it also follows that zombies are easy, because there's no squad coordination. Squad coordination is something that we spend a lot of time on in game AI. You don't have to do tricky things like figuring out when they need to reload and ducking behind cover, because they don't have guns. You don't have to do like sneaky tactics like flanking maneuvers and sort of working out where the vehicles are and stuff like that, because all you need to do as a zombie is go, where's the player? Right, that's the direction I'm walking. That's it. And zombies are actually a great way of avoiding having to do anything particularly smart with game AI. And I'm not saying that that's why people buy zombie games, and I'm not exactly saying that that's why developers make zombie games. I am saying it's an awfully convenient fact, though. So let's get into a little bit about what we could be doing instead, and why having random zombies shuffling about maybe isn't the best thing in the world. So we'll start out with a little bit of what is AI. So I get asked this on a regular basis, really, because I unwittingly sort of... People ask me what I do and I tell them, and they really end up wishing that they'd not asked me. So a lot of people, when you tell them that you work in AI, they kind of get this look on their face, and they kind of think that you're some crazy mad scientist. Because what they think of when they hear AI is this, right? And that's not actually what we're going to... I'm not trying to take... I'm not trying to take over the world today, at least. What I'm going to say for the purposes of this talk is that AI is the applied science of decisions. So we've got a lot of theoretical sciences of decisions. We've got stuff like game theory, and economics even is the study of sort of decision making. And when we talk about these in like a theoretical context, what that generally means is a bunch of academics sit around, they do a bunch of maths on a whiteboard, they get to some sort of result that says what they should do and what the right decision is, and then they clock off and that's them done. And what we know is that we have to take that sort of theoretical decision and apply it in some game world or some real world, if we're dealing with robotics, I mean, it's basically the same thing. AI is about actually automating that whole process and not just making the theory of the decision work, but hooking up the inputs from the world that we're working in into that process and the decision that comes out back into the world. And that is kind of what AI is. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to make the best decisions. But that's okay, because things that we sort of assume to be artificially intelligent, like robots, like Gurr here, I mean, Gurr is really quite dumb. But at the same time, there is no question that it is an artificial intelligence system. It is sort of a proper robot that's self-contained, that's making its own decisions. And it turns out that that's kind of how we see people, because we assume that all people are intelligent to some degree. But that doesn't actually mean that they're making good decisions in their lives. So if it's like a good, strong AI system that we're working with, it'll probably make good decisions. But whether it's making good decisions or not is completely separate from whether it's using AI. So, big question is, why is AI important in games? And, I mean, AI is kind of important because we have so many decisions in our game worlds that we need to make. And if we make them in advance, if we make them during development time, then that creates a very wooden, inflexible experience for our players. And we can do stuff that's actually a lot more flexible, a lot more adaptable, and we can create worlds that are under the control of an AI system. That's important. That is something that is sort of a skill that's not actually being utilized to its fullest. Kind of the next thing is, like, why is AI important? Well, it's because it's the next thing. Because this is Battlefield 3, so this is the Frostbite 2 engine. And this cost, I've given this particular slide so many times I ought to have looked up how much it cost, but I haven't. But it's like, it's millions, right? Development of this engine cost so much, and it took so much time, and it had such a big team working on it. But how much better than the previous version of the engine from, I think it was Frostbite 1.5, is this? Because it's not actually photorealistic. We can see that it's not real. And we are not really getting that much more as players out of it being X percent more real than the previous incarnation. So for all of this investment and all the time that we've put in to make this new shiny engine, we can still see that there's four soldiers in front of us, there's a helicopter overhead, we're not actually getting any more information to the player. So really, kind of what I'm saying is that graphics is becoming this thing where you can invest all this money and you're not actually getting a huge amount back. And if you want to look at something like physics is a great example of something that is actually dumb, because physics is as real as we want it to be and as real as we're going to get it. You know, if we hold a box, we know the weight of the box, we know how gravity is going to affect the box, and if we throw the box, we know how it's going to, you know, the arc of trajectory it's going to take, and when it hits something, we know how it's going to break apart, or we can sort of hack that up a bit so we know how it's going to break apart. So from a kind of simulating the world kind of point of view, we are capturing the big aspects of the world. We're not capturing stuff like quantum mechanics, because we don't understand that in the real world, so we don't understand it in the game world, and do we actually need it in the game world? But we have a very good understanding of physics. So we've got physics. We don't really want to spend any more time with graphics, because it's not getting us any further. So then, like, AI is kind of what's next. It's what's left if we take away everything else. And what we've done with AI to date has been clever tricks, but it's been lowest hanging fruit clever tricks. It's not really as deep as we can go with it. And part of that is that the time and money hasn't been spent there. Part of it is that we've needed the horsepower that's only now coming free. You know, when we've been working on these tightly constrained devices, then there hasn't been the kind of processing power to make something happen. But we're getting now to a point where there is spare cycles, where we are getting time back, where we can do nifty things with sideloading stuff onto the cell processor and get it off on the SPUs and get more processing for more processing than we would get normally. So that's kind of why AI is very important. But I'll just do a slide quickly on where we see AI. So typically, when particularly as gamers, when we start talking about AI, what we're generally talking about is this guy. And as gamers and in sort of the consumer press, AI is kind of synonymous with the enemy and the opponent. So we might say, well, the AI did this. And it'll be like, oh, the AI flanked me. Well, the AI didn't. The AI did, you know, all this clever stuff, but it made 3D models go around either side of you. That's a slightly different thing. But typically, when we talk about game AI, we're talking about the thing that motivates the NPC soldiers and aliens. I mean, that's kind of the standard way of looking at game AI. If we were talking about an RTS game, then there we go. Okay, so if we're talking about an RTS game, and here's a retro one just for you, we might be looking at the enemy generals and the way that the enemy generals are making their decisions. And then we would also have a separate layer of AI for each of the units. And then the units themselves might be individually intelligent, and they might do pathfinding for themselves, or they might react to attacks, this kind of thing. But this is sort of classically where we see AI used in games. And generally that's where kind of things stop. Because people think that AI is very scary. And one of the reasons that they think that AI is so scary is it really has had the worst spokesperson of all time. And we've had like two or three decades now of robo-exploitation movies reinforcing this idea that AI is completely evil. Another reason that's a bit more pragmatic is that AI has very few middleware solutions. So we're seeing stuff like Recast and Orca, which are navigation solutions, which will get you a nav mesh and build that up and work out the walkable aerials, all this kind of thing. But in terms of reasoning, in terms of decision logic, there aren't that many generally applicable frameworks. There aren't certainly that many generally applicable frameworks that actually work. So that generally means that you're going to have to roll your own thing. And you're going to need some sort of grounding in some knowledge representation kind of ideas, in the algorithms that we use in AI. And this is the kind of thing that you'll learn as part of a computer science degree, but you'll learn it in a different way to the way that we apply it in games. So this is an example of tic-tac-toe. And this is kind of highlighting just how computationally expensive the kinds of things that we would do in computer science become when we start trying to reason about a game. So what we're looking at here is a couple of moves ahead and plotting out the game tree for what's going to happen with that and working out whether we win or we lose. And you can see that quite rapidly it becomes this sort of combinatorial explosion kind of thing. That's all well and good, but for something as simple as tic-tac-toe to explode like that in what is the standard sort of here is how you do AI from a computer science degree, that's not that helpful. The other reason that it's not that helpful is because when we talk about AI in science and when we talk about it in universities in particular, we are generally looking at optimality and we want to create the best decision possible. So that might be like the shortest path from A to B or the best way of packing X items into a backpack or the cheapest manufacturing process to create this thing or the most efficient schedule in order to complete these jobs over these many machines. If we apply this kind of logic to games, we get a situation where we're just trying to beat the player. And, you know, that's not actually what we're trying to do. You know, we're not trying to think better than the player. We're not trying to react faster than the player. If that's what we want to do, if we want to just create hard opponents, turns out that rather than going down the AI route, it's actually a heck of a lot easier to just, like, change the rules of our world because we control the rules of our world. So we can make the NPCs move faster. We can have them have more health. We can give them bigger guns. And that actually makes the game harder. And it does it without requiring all these complicated AI routines. The big question, though, is that fun? Is it what we're actually trying to achieve? So Blizzard's Brian Schwab calls this the role of AI in games is losing with style. And what he sort of goes on to explain that as being a good dad, because as a parent, you are able in most games, at least I hope, to absolutely destroy your child. You know, if you're playing catch, you can throw the ball over the kid's head and there's no way he can catch it. You can throw it at his head and there's no way that he can catch it and he will fall down to the ground and start crying. At which point you can walk over and go, ha, 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 ha. That's not being a good dad. and what we're trying to do is, like, we're trying to create this sense where, you know, yes, we can destroy you as a player, but we don't want to do that. We want to give you an interesting challenge and find a clever way of allowing you as the player slash child to beat us as the game dev slash parent. And that kind of means that we need to create this beatable challenge and we need to manage frustration. We can't make it so that the player can never win, but we want to be able to make sure that the player can win provided they play reasonably. I mean, it shouldn't be the case that they can always win. So you need to kind of counter these two things, at which point Brian gets really deep on some philosophy stuff, and I don't understand it well enough to go there, so I'm just going to move on. So a great example of this is Batman. Batman Arkham Asylum, because I've not updated my slides in a long time, so this one's not a new slide. But this is a great example of this losing with style thing. Because if we wanted to sort of create these optimal thugs, then what we could do is we could do some Monte Carlo rollout, we could do maybe some neural network training to create really sophisticated thugs. We could get them communicating, you know, set up a blackboard and get each one working together with the other ones, throw in a bit of reasoning, some small unit tactics kind of stuff. And we could make some amazingly intelligent thugs. And we could use our AI know-how to create these guys who would just surround Batman and beat him into the ground. That's not really what we're trying to do, though, because the point of what we're trying to achieve with AI here isn't to beat Batman. It's to create an environment in which the player can become immersed in being Batman. And that is this big distinction between the two. So the big question becomes, like, how smart are these thugs in real life? And the answer is, well, not very. These are guys who have previously been arrested for something and been deemed dangerous enough to be thrown in Arkham Asylum. All this stuff is going down at Arkham Asylum, and rather than, like, sit in the corner and keep their heads down, like, you know, like me and you would do, they've gone, oh, I know, I'm going to sign up with Joker's gang. Joker has a 50-year history of getting his ass kicked by Batman. These are people who are making good decisions. So what we're trying to do really is model the real world. We're not trying to create these super thugs. And it sort of works the same for soldiers. So we know that your average soldier on the battlefield is not some sort of tactical genius. And we know that they're not sort of puffed up super soldier serum guys who have amazing reflexes and can do all these crazy things. And yet, if we apply what we learn from computer science into games, we end up in a position where we're trying to create this bastard offspring of Sun Tzu and Rambo. That's not actually what we're trying to achieve. So, coming back to zombies a little bit, I mean, what we know is that players will try to contextualize decisions, particularly like decisions of the NPC, based on what they know and what they think they know. So what we were just saying is that we kind of know that these thugs are dumb, so we expect them to act dumb. We know that soldiers are not dumb, but they're not the generals, they're not the guys who understand everything that's happening on the battlefield. They're the guys who hold the guns and get told which way to point them. And that sort of understanding of kind of what's going on at the player level can lead to a really bad reception if the characters don't act in the manner that the player is expecting. So let's consider... I'll just single them out. Crisis 2. Crisis 2 got slated at review for having really bad AI. And one of the reasons that I remember standing out in one review was that you would have two soldiers patrolling, and one of them gets killed. And the other guy does not react to that. He just carries on patrolling. And this was felt that like it was a really unrealistic response. The soldier wasn't acting like a soldier. But, I mean, that is kind of separate from the AI system, because what I want you to do now is I want you to think about the same level, the same scenario, but instead of it being two soldiers who are wandering around, it's two zombies. And one of them gets killed. It's completely now realistic and believable that the second zombie doesn't react to that. And, like, this highlights, really, that AI and the decision logic isn't really acting on its own. It's the combination of the AI system, the decision logic, the context, and then the player's expectations, because the player does not expect zombies to be clever. It expects soldiers to have some level of capability to them. And that's kind of why zombies are so favored as an NPC, because there is absolutely no expectation that anybody is going to do anything clever with game AI with them. That's kind of not fair, but let's say it anyway. So this is kind of where zombies are coming from. And this is something that I've faced recently. This is a game called Redshirt, which will be coming out. Last I heard, it was coming out summer of 2012, so I assume it will be out soon. So Redshirt is a game that's being developed in the UK by a small developer called The Tiniest Shark, and they contracted me in to provide the AI for this game. So the premise, really quick, is that you're playing as a generic crew member on a space station. So you are the Redshirt, and the aim is to try and climb the social and career ladder through your interactions with the rest of the crew, which is all taking place on Spacebook. So it's like this simulated parody of a social network that you're interacting with everybody through. And this kind of concept of anthropomorphizing stuff and player expectations, it becomes really important here, because what we're doing is we're creating persistent companions for the player to interact with. And that kind of means that we've got to model personalities, and we've got to stay true to those personalities. So at the top of the image there, we've got this character called Astra. Now, in my playthrough here, I've got a relationship with Astra. I know what we've done in the past. I know how she's reacted to things. I've kind of got a sense for what she likes and doesn't like. And because of that, I've kind of got this model in my head of how this character works, and I've built up these kind of prejudices about how I expect that character to behave. And if we do something that's out of character, people are not going to give us the benefit of the doubt, unfortunately. Like, if somebody were to do something out of character, like you're sort of mopey, well, let's do it the other way. Your happy, smiley friend suddenly gets really dark on Facebook. You're going to turn around to them and say, like, oh, what's going on in your life? What's happening? If one of our characters does this in Spacebook, the players are just going to turn around and say that our AI is crap, which doesn't really give us much wiggle room for actually sticking to these personalities. So again, what we're seeing is that kind of we've got to design our characters in such a way that the game and the characters and the AI kind of all overlap in a way. And really that's kind of one of the big takeaways from this, is that design and AI kind of have to go together, and they can't be kept in isolation, because what is happening with one is going to influence the other, exactly like we saw with the soldiers and the zombies. But it's okay, because players are stupid, and we can actually use all of this against them. So leveraging anthropomorphism is actually a really clever trick, because we know that players want to believe what's happening in the game world. It would be ridiculous if they didn't, because, I mean, at the end of the day, I sit in my living room and pretend that I'm on a spaceship blowing stuff up, and unless I'm prepared to sort of suspend my disbelief for a bit and put myself into that character, the whole thing really doesn't work. So it turns out that because the player wants to believe, it doesn't actually matter how sophisticated the AI system is. It's how sophisticated the player thinks it is. And because of that, we can get away with a couple of tricks here, which pretty much is if we do something in the game world, if we provide a context that justifies that, then the player will actually fill in the narrative for us and create, like, they'll flesh out that context. So this has been scientifically proven, well, roughly scientifically proven. But a guy called Baylor Wetzel at University of Minneapolis, he did an experiment, and what he did was he mocked up a turn-based fantasy war game. It wasn't, you know, it didn't look special. It was an academic project. You know how academic projects tend to look. Programmer art is really stretching the term to its absolute maximum. But the way this thing worked is that players would choose which units on the enemy battlefield to attack, and once they cleared out all the enemy units, they could then go for the enemy castle. And he had a bunch of his students play against a range of AI opponents, and he conducted a survey afterwards. And part of the survey was based around, like, how strongly they felt that the player, the AI was playing and all this kind of stuff. But the most interesting part of it, at least to me, was that he asked one question, which was, what strategy did the AI use? And he got back these amazing, amazing responses. And one that I will always remember is this guy who wrote this thing about the AI system is very aware of what the units are on the battlefield and what the strengths are, and it understands that the dragon is the most important unit, so it has to kill the dragon first. And once it's killed the dragon, then it can whittle away at the other units, and then it can go for the castle. But it has to kill the dragon first. And that's this amazing tactic. That's brilliant. That's exactly what I think we should do. And it turned out that the way Baylor had set that particular bot up, the dragon was called the Black Noble Dragon, and it had the longest unit name. And that is what it was using to justify its attack. So it went for it goes for the longest name, but the player can see a pattern that maybe isn't there, but the player then creates this narrative about why it's doing that. And what we can do with that is use a system called barks. And barks are kind of a way that we can signal to the player what our AI system is actually thinking. And I use thinking with inverted commas because, like, it doesn't actually have to be what's happening inside the AI system. So, for example, and this is a really good example, and if anybody ever uses this one, you know, just take it, put it in your pocket. This is a great trick. You've got an AI system. It's a clever AI system. It doesn't generate decisions immediately. It needs a few frames extra, maybe a few seconds extra, to get its bearings, to get a decision out. Have an audio clip that says, "I'm reloading." And suddenly you have a justification for why your NPC isn't doing anything right now, just by playing that audio clip. I mean, it's a brilliant hack that convinces the player that something sophisticated is happening, when nothing sophisticated is happening at all. So, I mean, you just shout out that. I mean, this is something that kind of we've seen all over the place, particularly in poker, where, you know, if you're sat playing poker with somebody, like, you expect them to be kind of bluffing and faking you out and saying the wrong thing. But you kind of don't take that into game development and feel like you can apply the same practices to actually completely mess with the player that you're developing for. But you can, because it is all smoke and mirrors at the end of the day. None of this is actually real. And if we can hack up a system like this that can convince the player that something interesting is happening, when nothing interesting is happening. Battlefield Bad Company 2 is another great example. There is one scene I can't remember the whole thing to it, but this was from a talk at the Paris Gaming AI conference a few years ago. There's one bit where you come around a hill and there's a massive combat in progress, and you're staring down the barrel of an enemy tank and a whole bunch of guys are running at you. And they're firing like mad, and it's this climactic sort of oh shit kind of moment. None of those people are actually shooting anywhere near you. They are all shooting above your head. There is no way they can hit you. But they are generating this context where you just assume that they're shooting at you, and it's creating an atmosphere. And it's all tricks, and it's all smoke and mirrors. But it's actually really easy to do this kind of thing. So I've kind of been talking about character AI for the last 40 minutes or so. And this is kind of, it's what people focus on. When we're talking about game AI, we focus on characters. And I've got another talk. This is kind of the evolution of that talk. It's on YouTube. You can find it easily enough by looking for my name on YouTube. And that focuses a lot on everything beyond the game AI for the characters. So what I was talking about there was the kind of things that we could take from the tabletop RPGs, like Dungeons & Dragons. And we can think in terms of using AI systems to create dungeon masters and actually control the flow of the game and manage the experience that the player has. And it's, again, coming back to this sense of managing frustration and challenge and creating a very sort of good dad experience. But that's not this talk, but this is kind of like the evolution of that talk, because we've talked about these fancy ways that we can think about game AI, but in as much as we're sort of looking at joining together AI and design and saying that these two things go hand in hand, well, at the same time, we kind of need to do the reverse of that, which is to say not just that our design has to inform our AI and our AI has to inform our design, but as AI developers, we kind of have to give back. It's not just a one-way street. We actually have to provide stuff back. Because if we have these shiny AI algorithms, well, that's brilliant. But literally nobody cares about our AI algorithms except us. We can have these amazing pieces of code that are, going to solve everything. If the designer can't use them, then it's of absolutely no use to anybody. So it turns out that a big chunk of being an AI developer is actually being a tools developer. Because when we want to do things like change the way an NPC works, change the way a procedural content system works to create different chunks of content for our game, we maybe want to change the tone of the fourth to the eighth level, say. It is absolutely no use to anybody if we have to go back to the code for that. So, like I say, a big part of being an AI developer is actually tools. So here is one example of this. So this is actually an early example I grabbed for the Redshirt game. And like I said, I was contracted for this, which is why I love using stuff like this, because this is actually this is a system called Behave, which works in Unity. And it's a behavior tree editor. And let me see. I can't get my cursor over there. So you can see that there's nodes at the bottom of the tree that have got circles in. Those correspond to code blocks. There's these question marks at the top, like a gray with a question mark in it. Those are corresponding to selectors that are choosing which of the blocks and subtrees are going to be active. And because we can map these out visually, I was in a position where I could set all the whole thing up. We could look at writing the code blocks for implementing each action. And then I can walk away from that project, and the developer now can, without having to rewrite the whole AI system, without really having to understand the AI system, they can chop and change and move the blocks around and rewire it pretty much to their heart's content. But it's making it so much easier for them to do that. So another great example of this, which doesn't seem to be on the slides, although I was going to try and grab a screenshot of it, just expose stuff. If you're writing code and it's got parameters, expose it in the Unity editor, or what if you don't have a Unity, if you're not in Unity, just knock up a little config file, because you don't want the designers to have to go to the code, and the designers don't want to have to come to the programmers whenever they need like behaviors changed or anything like that. So, nearly finished, heading into the summary slide now. So what I want you to kind of take away from this talk, AI is a vastly underutilized tool for devs. We're not even scratching the surface of what we can actually do with AI, how we can use it to inform both our development processes and our development and our designs. We really need to be tying AI and design together much more tightly than we do, particularly than with other disciplines. You know, it's not a sub-area of programming, because you know, if it, it's great for designers who say, "Oh, okay, do this, this, and this, you know, here's the design doc, make it happen." That's great, but generally the design doc is like however many pages of the game as the player interacts with the world. And there's maybe two paragraphs on how the NPCs interact with the world. There isn't actually this sort of approach that says that the AI characters and the AI decisions and the way the world works is so important, because that's actually creating the experience that the player is going to have. And that kind of makes it very important. It becomes this thing that if you're not thinking about AI at design time, you're not creating this engaging world. And like I said, that's a two-way street. You can't just expect, as an AI developer, to go, okay, right, tell me about your design. Right, okay, here's what we can do. Here's the design doc. Right, I'm now a coder again. That's me done. You actually have to be providing those tools back to the designers, to the level designers who can do for tweaking the procedural content or whatever it is. It's very much a two-way street, and we need to be making much more use of that street, because AI is the next big thing, and AI does not need to be scary. It doesn't need to be this thing that people shy away from. They should be embracing it. So that is all the content of my AI talk. I can't leave you guys this week without telling you a little bit about the IGDA scholarships. I know Spencer has probably told you already, and I know he's got his application in already. The IGDA scholarships are a phenomenal opportunity. They offer you a free VIP-style pass to attend GDC, E3, Casual Connect America, as it is now styled, Tokyo Game Show, or CDEC. It is available to students. I don't know how many of you in the room are students. The reason that I'm telling you about this today, the reason I'm making a point of putting it up on the slides, applications for coming to GDC with us close on Friday. So if you want to be getting in as part of the best and brightest students, well, we accepted me and Spencer, so it's not actually that sort of stringently the best and brightest. No, it's a great opportunity. Like I said, I got three of these things. I cannot speak highly enough about the program, even though I run it now. Spencer got to come to Casual Connect. I was there. We had a great time at Casual Connect. So that is the link if you want to learn more, if you want to apply. Like I said, GDC applications close on Friday. We'll be opening E3 applications in a couple of weeks. So thank you very much. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It has not felt like it's been 2 a.m. So that is my contact info. You can get me on Twitter most reliably. I do reply to emails eventually, unless I don't. Generally, if I don't reply to an email, it's because I've forgotten to put a star on your email. So if I don't reply to something and you've asked me a question, just get in my face about it, and I will always be willing to answer. There's my website as well. There's some stuff on there. And I'm doing a new thing now. I've been doing this for the past few weeks. On Fridays, ask me a question on Formspring about games or about AI or about anything, and I will try to get back to you about it. So Formspring is the new place to ask me about game AI, but you can also ask me about email or anywhere else. So thank you very much for your attention, and I guess we've got a few minutes for questions.
Okay. Hey, Luke, this is Spencer. With zombies being old hat, what do you expect the AI to do? What do you want the AI to do in games for now? Is it experiences like we see in Facade, or is it Prom Night, or Prom Week? I mean, is it supposed to be that sophisticated AI so that NPCs are interacting in completely different dialogue streams, or what do you hope to see things come into?
Right, I've just changed microphones. Can you guys still hear me?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So that's kind of a big, broad, let's go for half an hour kind of question. But, I mean, the big thing for me is companions. And I don't think anybody will disagree that companions right now... So, in terms of game AI, what people have been saying for a little while now is that game AI is good enough. And coming back to that, in fact, it's that same Battlefield talk that I mentioned a bit ago, one of the metrics that they gave is that their average NPC lifespan is 5 seconds. it makes sense to an extent, because like when you've got an NPC that lasts 5 seconds, its job is to run on the screen, get shot in the face and fall over, right? And the question becomes, how smart does an NPC need to be for that to happen? Not very smart, right? But what they have in Bad Company 2 in particular is they have these outliers where they have companions that are going to stay with you throughout the game. And I don't know, I mean, Bad Company 2 in particular, those guys are retarded. And if anybody has a copy, load it up, go back, play through a little bit, and watch the pathfinding. Because this is the other trick that they've missed, is that companions, you know, your squad mates in Bad Company 2, are visible on your minimap. And they show which way they're heading. So you can see them get completely confused, spin around in a circle for a bit, and then rubber band and teleport to you, or nearer to you. And that's really bad, because like companions should be much more intelligent than soldiers. And this is kind of what we're now drifting towards, my sort of research area, which is trying to make very smart, very intelligent companions who can understand what you're trying to achieve as a player and help you to achieve that or not help you to achieve that. Because so much of what we classically think of as AI is actually pre-scripted sequences, and we've managed to design it in such a way that we can't see that there is no way for the player to impact that sequence. So if you imagine a game, I can't think of a specific example, but imagine a game like Portal 2. I think that a lot of games have this. Two buttons on a wall. Press both buttons, open the door. Right? So you will have a companion who has to go over and press one button, and you have to press the other button. There will be something in the design of that scenario such that you can't interfere with which one that character is going to press. And he will always go for the right button, which leaves you feeling like you've had the option, but you just couldn't like get to the right button first, so you had to go to the left button. The game makes the choice for you. The designer is making the choice for you. And what my work's been kind of focused on is ways that we can reason about this and ways that we can actually represent this to the companion, bearing in mind that we don't have a lot of horsepower available. I mean, we're talking about AI routines getting more horsepower now, but we're still talking about sort of 60 frames a second, 60 milliseconds a frame, 10% of that might go to AI, 1 or 2 milliseconds per frame. And we've got to do a lot of decision logic in that time. So, like, the kind of reasoning that we're talking about there could be solved using classical AI systems, which are, they're working in piece-based complete complexity class. Piece-based complete is the kind of complexity class that is just death. Like, you talking 7 gigs of RAM and half an hour for a solution. And we're saying, oh, well, we've got 1 millisecond and whatever RAM we can prize out of everybody else's hands. So, like, where things are going to go is, I mean, you mentioned Prom Week, so that's slightly different in as much as that's more on the sort of NLP relationship kind of stuff, and that's important too. I mean, long term, what I want to see is general AI, but I mean, general AI is so far away. But wouldn't it be amazing, as a sort of 50-year goal, 20-year goal, maybe. If we could say, right, I want 5 extras in here, and these are enemy soldiers, and here is your motivation. And instead of it being like this weird pre-scripted scenario, we're actually creating, we're working in the same way as we work with film, where we have a director rather than a developer. And we just sort of set it up and say, right, here's you guys, and here's what you're going to do, and the player's going to come in that door, and go. And it becomes like this sort of cinematic slash improvisation thing. So yeah, I think that's probably where I would like things to go. And I've rambled for long enough on this question, I think.
My name's Rhett Akers. I had a question about, talk about AI and stuff as far as like maybe role-playing game or storyline games go. You ever find yourself studying anything in psychology and human behavior in order to know how to make AI act, in order to immerse like maybe more simple-minded players or just players in general into the game and keep them, into the game and into the mood of everything? Just studying behavior in general, just in order to try to simulate it.
I don't. Because I can't stand people. it's a very good question. It's a very sort of insightful question. A lot of AI developers do. There is sort of this branch of AI guys who are more interested in stuff like animation, and they will be very much focusing on like how people walk and how people position their hands and their feet. That's not at all what I'm interested in. I like maths. Like I said, I don't like people, I do like maths. So I'm much more on that side of things. But both are very important, and you can't get good behavior without A, understanding the maths behind the decisions that lead to that behavior, and then secondly, actually being able to convey that behavior in a very believable way, which kind of is where that kind of thing comes in.
Sweet. So you probably find yourself working with a guy on the team that like is in charge of writing a storyline or developing the personality of the characters in that sort of sense. And you'd probably be having to put your minds together, just doing that sort of work together.
Yeah, I mean, some of that is... So, I mean, I've not really got that much experience of dealing with sort of storyline stuff, but my understanding is that, like, storyline tends to happen separately, and then character design happens in concert with the narrative design, and then from there, you'll end up with, like, the character, and then somebody who is probably the animator, and the animator and the AI guys kind of get together for how they're going to make that character look and feel. So, really, it's not so much that we're together with the AI guys. The AI guys are together with the writers. It's that the writers are kind of supplying us with a job, with like, here is the specifications of what we need you to fulfill. We need a sneaky evil guy. And you say, okay, well, let's take a sneaky evil guy, and he's going to say this, that, and the other. So let's actually find out what it means to be a sneaky evil guy. By finding one on the street, which, okay, the whole thing forms about a little bit there. But this is the kind of thing where there's a guy called Phil Carlisle over here in the UK. He was part of the UK, the original Team 17, the Worms guys. And one of the things he does, which is incredibly creepy in a way, is he just goes out with a video camera and he just records people.
Awesome.
And, like, that's kind of creepy, but at the same time, like, he's getting a lot of stock footage of, like, how people interact with the world. And from there, he's got a good sense of, like, different sort of stereotypes of people. So he's kind of the guy that you go to for that kind of thing. And I'm not at all. So I think probably we've exhausted everything that I can tell you about this particular area.
That's pretty cool. I guess I'll take a camera to the park and try that.
Worked out for you.
Just as long as I don't put it on YouTube, right?
other questions?
So, any other questions?
We didn't necessarily talk about some specific ways to approach AI in development, like algorithms and things. Is there some really good resources for someone who's kind of new to it to dive in more on the development side and find some of the current approaches?
Yeah, so if you can get your hands on... So that this textbook I mentioned at the beginning, that one doesn't come out until later on in summer, I think. But it's actually the fifth in a series. We've changed publisher for the series, so we've had to change the name. But if you can get your hands on the Game AI Wisdom, it's called. And there's four books in that series, which are same kind of deal, where it's articles about the ways that different developers have tackled problems in different games. They always have some intro level stuff, and then ramping up to some AAA technical stuff. So if you can get your hands on them, probably for a beginner sort of level, I would not recommend buying them all, because like there's stuff in there that's just not going to be helpful to you. But if you can get them at a library, that kind of thing, or get them used maybe, that's probably a good way to go. There's the AIGameDev.com website, which has a lot of information. A lot of that information I find is more targeted at people who are already AI developers. You'll find some good resources for that on altdevbloggerday.com, particularly behavior trees. Behavior trees are very in fashion now for driving NPCs, and there's a guy on altdev called Bjorn Naffler. Probably ought to spell that. B-J... Hang on, I need to look it up. B-J-O-E-R-N... K-N-A-F-L-A. And you'll find his articles on behavior trees are really good. They're my go-to for, well, both for understanding behavior trees and also for showing students about them. I can keep your ear to the ground for the AI SIG. We're going to be collecting. We've got a new website in the works. Finally, it's only taken about 6 months to get that authorized. welcome to the IGDA. We'll be collecting resources together there, and sort of getting as much together as we can. And in the meantime, like I say, I'm quite happy to answer pretty much anything. So just ask me a question on FormSpring, and I'll point you in the right direction for what you're trying to do, whether it's pathfinding or decision logic, or sort of point you in the right direction a little bit for animation stuff. So that is your brain dump of where you can find resources to get you started.
Thank you.
All right, I think we'll let you go. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, guys. I will go straight away because it is after 3 now. But thank you very much for having me. If you ever have any questions at all, just shout out. Catch you later.